August 25th, 2018. I was on my way today to a little overlook on the Fifth Avenue Bridge in downtown Olympia to witness what to me seemed utterly implausible. Salmon running on their way back to their birthplaces to spawn. Yes, I knew salmon ran this way all over the Northwest. It just never crossed my mind that I could watch such a spectacle right in the middle of town. The Fifth Avenue Bridge is short, maybe 80 feet or so, spanning the narrow vesicle of water where the last tiniest finger of Puget Sound's salt water ends at the tip of Bud Bay and continental freshwater begins at Capitol Lake, a man-made body of water at the mouth of the Deschutes River. There is a small viewing platform there specifically for people like me to watch the run. I'd been there a few days before, waited maybe an hour and a half. I did see thousands of little fish, sticklebacks, I learned from the signage on the fence along the bridge, which also migrate upstream to spawn. But no salmon. People came along, spottily, waited a few minutes and went, either not having as much time as I did or knowing something I didn't yet. I kept waiting. After a while, I started up a conversation with a young man who seemed to be an experienced witness and found out it was entirely a hit-and-miss proposition, this salmon viewing. High and low tides were the most likely times for the salmon to be there, but it could be any other time as well. He left after about 10 minutes on the assumption, I guess, that this was not going to be one of those times. Around 5 o'clock, maybe 40 minutes into my wait, one of the volunteer stewards, a man named Jim, around my age, showed up for his evening shift. He knew a lot, had worked in a hatchery, studied salmon, their life cycles, etc. I talked to him casually for a half hour or so. Found out, for example, that the salmon station and swirl around there below the bridge, sometimes for hours, even days, to make the transition from salt to fresh water, a process of acclimation. Around 5:30, I left without having seen any salmon. But at least I knew something and figured I'd just stop by there any time I was downtown, take my chances, until I saw them. Today I did. Many hundreds of what another steward told me were coho salmon, swirling in and out and around at the base of the bridge, waiting for the right conditions and moment to head up the ladder into the lake. It was hard to make them out in the dark water 10 feet below me, but it was a stunning sight to see. Herds of variegated dark green fish, each about 2 feet long, rushing up in waves and then retreating back into the black. I took a bunch of photos with my phone, but found out later, looking them over, that the camera lens was not equivalent to eyes. I couldn't see the mottled backs of any fish in any of them. There were two or three harbor seals cruising around maybe 100 feet out in Bud Bay. I could see their little heads surface here and there from time to time. They looked to be about 4 feet long, roundish, very cute-looking to human eyes. Not so to salmon eyes. Every now and then, the salmon would become agitated, swirl around on the surface, even breach, water boiling up from beneath. Then one of the harbor seals would surface with the salmon still flapping in its mouth. The seal would take the salmon back out to the fringes to eat its meal, a few seagulls sitting quietly on the water, waiting for scraps. Three great blue herons glided around and settled here and there on the banks, sometimes sweeping in right below me from under the bridge. It was a stunning tableau, disproportionately grand for my eastern lake-schooled eyes to grapple with. Made even more so because I was standing right in the middle of town at the side of a bridge full of traffic. But this is not primarily what I want to write about here. As is so often the case, it is incidental things, what I'll call haphazards, that end up giving shape to unfamiliar experiences, and I had one of those occur on my way to this second viewing. Right before you get to the bridge, there is a small cafe with a folk art gift shop attached. Since I wasn't in any hurry to get to the overlook and figured I might not see the salmon this time either, I just wandered in there to look around. The inventory was the kind of fair trade craft items you might find in stores like this anywhere. There is one, for example, in the Squirrel Hill neighborhood in Pittsburgh. Ceramics, fabric, small artifacts, all handmade by native craftspeople around the world. The one distinctive and unusual display was an array of Indian tribal fetishes, little carved animals, bears in particular, with tokens strapped on their backs. They were in a locked case, without visible pricing, so I assumed they were more than I wanted to spend right then. The checkout counter was being worked by a very young woman, maybe 20 or so, full of quiet vitality, smiling at everyone, a genuine smile, cheerful. Two equally young men, most likely students from Evergreen College, long hair, hippie-style clothing, sweet demeanor, were talking with her, asking her questions. Real questions, I thought, not the kind of chatting up a man might initiate to see if a woman will go out with him. Where are you from? The Philippines. How long have you been in this country? A few months. Where else have you been? Just here. Indicating to me that she might also be here to study at Evergreen College, which may have been part of this ongoing conversation before I tuned into it. And finally, what do you think of Olympia? She smiled and said, with an air of wistful wisdom, "It has many layers." That was it. It has many layers. The young men agreed, and I wandered off to see the salmon, leaving these three to whatever serendipitous paths their engagement might take from there. I, too, have been in Olympia for just a few months now. I had no more idea what to expect from this place, I suppose, than this young woman from the Philippines did. I've lived my whole life up until now in the East, the previous 40 years in Pittsburgh. That was the cultural and natural world I was habituated to, deeply. I knew Olympia would be different. It's much smaller, first of all, population about 50,000. The houses are simpler. In my neighborhood, most are 80 to 100 years old, cottage-like, one-story, wood-framed, weathered-looking. Every house I lived in Pittsburgh was much sturdier seeming, two stories, all brick and stone and slate, basic housing stock back there. The closest analogies for my new neighborhood that I had in my head were the Atlantic coastal beach towns 30 or 40 years ago, before they got big-boxed and millionaire-built out of their charm. Olympia still had that charm, the same air of almost quaint uniqueness, one of the other combinations of words I had been toying with to try to say what it was like here. Then at my neighborhood fair a few weeks ago, I just haphazardly started up a conversation with a very kind woman named Carla. We were both cramming ourselves into a little spot of shade. It was bright, hot, sunny that day. To listen to a folk-type band, two guitars and a fiddle, playing lovely Irish music, the kind that brings a tear to my eye when I hear it. Not happy or sad, necessarily, just deeply sweet and moving. Part of my personal heritage. Carla was, coincidentally, just back to Olympia from travels in Ireland. So we talked a bit about that, about why she was here, I was here. I said I really liked Olympia, and she did too. Her word for it was quirky, also accurate, in the sense that whenever you think you have a handle on it, something surprising strides by to say, wait a minute. Like that street fair, so laid back, so colorful, so friendly. Or the salmon. But the word I'm going with now is the one this young woman from the Philippines gave me. Layers. So, layers. Like what? Well, I'll start with my house. I was in a big, big rush to leave Pittsburgh this spring, about 10 seconds after I retired, if I could. As it turned out, it took me a couple of weeks to sell my house, dispose of my belongings, and find a place here. My daughter scouted out a few I found online one Friday afternoon. That night, when she called to report, I could tell from her voice how stressed she was with work, her own life here, and I knew I needed to decide right then which of the three she'd seen I'd take. They were all very different. An urban industrial-look apartment in a multi-unit building right downtown. A luxurious VRBO Airbnb-type condo for long-term rental, fully furnished, right on Capitol Lake, also downtown. And the place I ended up taking, this bungalow just up the hill from downtown. I'd been looking online for a couple of weeks. I'm pretty sure that this was the first place I clicked on to get the details. I thought then, somewhere deep in the back of my head, that I would end up here. But I didn't know if it was for better or worse. Bridget sent me a couple of pictures she'd taken of it that day. There were some renovations ongoing, so a lot of disarray. All she said was, "This place is great." I asked her later why she thought that, given the unfinished state of it. She said because it had a good feel about it, and she trusted the man working on it, who told her it would be ready by my arrival date, as it was. One of the reasons I had Bridget look at places for me instead of flying out, for example, to see them myself, is that I trust her implicitly and completely, even more than I might trust myself in a situation like this. She is utterly honest in her appraisal of everything, and rarely, if ever, fooled by appearances or salesmanship. And she knows me. For example, all she said about the downtown apartment was she wasn't sure if it was my speed. I crossed it off my list right then. The other one, well, she liked that one quite a lot. If I knew for sure I was only going to be here for a few months, I would have taken it. But then, if I stayed, I'd have to move again. And really, no matter how long I was here, I wanted my own stuff. Most especially, my kids' artwork on my walls. Not possible in a place already fully decorated. So I took the bungalow. I had no clear idea, really, how big it was. I assumed small, from the outward appearance, the facade. How finished it would be for livability. The photos showed a lot of upset and missing things. Or what the neighborhood was like. But I took it anyway, to relieve Bridget's stress and mine. Done. Come what may, I thought. When I actually opened the door to the place, I was stunned. Not only was it charming, a sunroom, a huge stone fireplace, but large, spacious rooms, two bedrooms, and a laundry room, in addition to the living room, dining room, sunroom, big kitchen, simple but more than ample, nice bathroom, clean, big tub for baths. It was a real house, as big as the one I was leaving, which I thought would be impossible. Big enough to display all of the artwork I took with me on its many freshly painted walls and shelves. That's what I mean by layers. I see a tiny image online of a place that looks equally tiny. Behind the door is everything I could ever have wanted and more. One of the things I most like in general about Olympia is the visual humility of its housing stock. The neighborhood I live in, Bigelow Highlands, is well over 100 years old. There is, in fact, a Bigelow House, the Ur House, for what's up on this hill, open for public tours, which reminds me I need to do that one of these days. It was built in 1859. My house was built in the mid-1920s, as were, I assume, many of the other houses around me, since they look similar. Cottage-type houses, all different in appearance, but sharing these features, simple, wood-framed, one-story, craftsman-style roofs and porches, weathered surfaces on the outside, but colorfully painted, warm-looking. A few have been rehabbed to enhance sale value, I assume, but most are deceptively plain. I assume, like mine, they have many layers. Like once you go in, you just can't believe how welcoming it is, how kind it feels toward your presence. How beautiful all the old stuff is. That massive riverstone fireplace in my living room, say, clearly hand-built, with the black steel wood stove built in, industrial strength, for heat, not just ambience, though the latter comes with the former. The basic kitchen cabinetry, unpainted wood, clearly hand-built on site from plywood, the doors, single sheets to prevent warping, or one by pine, including a series of little rounded shelves beside the over-sink window to display small decorative artifacts. The kind of kitchen you'd never find in a brick-built home back in Pittsburgh. The kind of kitchen that would bring out the sledgehammers and crowbars on the Home and Garden Channel. The kind of kitchen you feel at home in instantly. At ease, broken in, waiting patiently to receive your dishes, your food, and you. Mine has an old-style linoleum floor, marmoleum they called it, recently enough installed not to be worn through. A nice little window over the sink where I stand and wash dishes because there is no dishwasher. I thought that would be a drag, a constant irritation, but it's not. It's not the opposite either, some wonderfully zen moment maker in my day. It just makes that window something I get to look through for a few relatively pleasant minutes a few times a day. And when you're alone, there aren't that many dishes after all. Soap, wash, rinse, done. A nice metaphor for life, maybe. And food. Layers there, too. Olympia is, as I said, a town of 50,000. You'd think there would be a few good restaurants, a bunch of fast food places, and that's it. Not so. For one thing, the city at some point zoned its downtown to keep out franchises and big boxes. So everything there is a local business. Maybe because Olympia is the state capital, or who knows why. Among those businesses are dozens of restaurants, each one unique. Bridget loves fine food and going out, so she and her husband Mark know all of them very well, as in they are recognized by name in many of them. And they know which one is the best for what. Steaks, salmon, oysters, pizza, pasta, tacos, beer, wine, cider, coffee, tea, desserts, cocktails, gelato, you name it. There are places to find it at its best. And they took me to them. Those layers might have taken me many months, even years, to peel back. I'm sure it took them some time to create the catalog. But as stunned as I was by my house, I was more stunned by the diversity and quality of the local cuisine. I knew a lot of Pennsylvania towns with 50,000 people. You'd be lucky in many of them to find one good meal, let alone a good meal on every block. Want to eat at home, as I do most often? Go to the farmer's market for fresh vegetables, fruit, fish, and all kinds of other treats. Or walk to my local market, a little pricey by Pittsburgh standards, but the best meat and dairy products I've found in a standard grocery store maybe ever. I eat great food every day. And I want to indulge in something unhealthy. There are three places within walking distance of my house where I can get a burger properly incinerated to my taste, or a thick sandwich made with real meat, or crunchy fries, or fried anything. And beyond that, the local culture fosters and supports not only multiple craft brewers of beer and, my new favorite, ciders of all kinds, even vinegars, but also a plethora of coffee places that roast their own beans and tea places that mix their own blends and bakeries, at least a half a dozen you want to keep going back to, one for their breads, one for their macaroons, one for their puff pastries, one for their fruit pastries, and on and on. And handmade chocolates, and, well, you get the drift. All of this, right there, within 2 miles of my house. That's layers upon layers with layers in my book. Want to shop instead of eat? Well, there is an olive oil store, a violin store, a locally produced cheese store, a used guitar store. I mean, that's exactly what and all each sells. And arts and crafts stores, photographs, paintings, ceramics, metalwork, almost any media you might think of, around every corner. And antique, vintage, junk stores. Same thing, everywhere you turn. And a great, I mean great, hardware store. The old style kind, with everything you might ever need, hardware-wise. And, well, again, you get the drift. When every business is local instead of franchised, it is one of a kind. Charming, unique, quirky. All creating an ensemble. Many, many layers. And I still haven't gotten to the biggest thing with layers here. The natural environs, which I have struggled not only to grasp visually, so copious and grand it is, but to name for others, relying so far on weak words like majestic or awesome to handle that business. I won't go into that here. The essays I expect to write this month will, as is my custom, be founded on my walks in the woods. Though right now, woods seems about as weak a word for the places I'm haunting as majestic and awesome seem as modifiers for it. I want to end my opening piece this way. Today, the first day I'm actually able to process my perceptions of this new place into serviceable words, is, by happenstance or not, Carol's birthday. She would be 65 today. I have an inner contradictory reaction to all the special days I associate with Carol. It seems inappropriate to celebrate them, yet I cannot let them pass without stopping to pay attention to them, kind of like the character in Frost stopping by woods on a snowy evening. These days are lovely, dark, and deep. They are promises I keep. They still me to silence, in that I generally experience them entirely privately. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. When I am by necessity on those days with others, they may happen to notice for a second or two, as we often do when someone we are with lets down their guard for a moment, lifts the shades of the public person, just enough to give a glimpse inside, like those old roller shades that might zoom all the way up when we just want to adjust them slightly, and stunned by all that light, we zip them back down all the way very quickly. There is some mystery that becomes momentarily visible. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. This year, though, Bridget invited me over on the 24th for dinner. We had spaghetti, one of the foundational staples of our family life while she and Joe were growing up. Comfort food for all of us. And she mentioned that tomorrow is Mom's birthday. How she always has spaghetti on its eve, her way of honoring Carol. I was deeply touched, moist eyes, not crying, not sad, just touched, complexly so. Layers. Partly I realized that, of course, how stupid of me. Carol's birthday means something of consequence to others besides me. Bridget noticed this day, too. How sweet. And then the other side of it, the sad side, that Bridget had to feel what I feel, this great loss. How I wished, all the time wish, I could somehow redeem Bridget and Joe from that inevitable sadness. And I can't. No, I can't. No, I shouldn't. The death is somehow greater than and beyond even the deepest love. That safety is nowhere on days like this. Yes, you can ignore it. Pretend it is not there. That specter that waits around the corner for all of us. But that is even more stupid than taking the turn to face it. So serene in its presence. So dark. Incalculably dark. So sad and beautiful all at the same time. Everything lost and found in a moment of recognition. We had such a nice meal together. Talked mostly about our lives now. What was going on. Carol was, though, with us, I know, in spirit, to hear it. And that's where I'll stop with this paragraph. Before it turns into another and another, as it easily could, if I let it. As it could every moment of every day, if I let it. The line between stupid and smart is a very fine one. That fine line is right here.